Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent, and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio, and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher, who's not here, and me, Samuel Mann. Shane's not here tonight because I'm in Copenhagen in Denmark. I'm in the offices of Dr. Hans Brønnings, who is the Executive Director of the European Environment Agency. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
You gave a keynote speech this morning at the Environmental Informatics and ICT4S conference combined, and it got a fantastic reception. Was it a surprise, because you were challenging things?
Yeah, I think it's also a time where we have to challenge things, because we've been building on decades of environmental policies and climate policies and sustainable development policies. And we've been reaping the benefits of that. But at the same time, we notice that the fundamental challenges which we are changing, we may not have addressed in a way that is really going to the core of things. So we need to challenge ourselves through better analysis of what is driving the fundamental unsustainability of, you know, how we produce things and how we consume. And at the same time, how do we overcome that? And how do we organize a transition towards more fundamental sustainability on this planet? And that will require challenging those who are involved in the systems, but also those who provide the knowledge about the environment and about climate and about sustainability. And the community that was gathering today plays a key role in that, because those are the people that built the ICT systems and that work with the modern technology and that have been thinking about innovation in terms of big data and, you know, all of those things. So how is this connected to the necessity to move into a next step of fundamental sustainability? That's a key question.
I want to take a few steps back first. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Belgium. I'm from the Flemish part of Belgium. I grew up in and around Antwerp. I'm a city boy. Yeah. And I spent quite some time, about 6 years in the US altogether. I worked for a couple of years in the Netherlands, but I'm in essence a Belgian citizen, and I spent most of my life there.
You first trained as a political scientist.
Yep.
What led you to that?
I had several options, and one option that was the most evident was that I would go into sports science, physical education, physiotherapy, because I was kind of completely absorbed by those types of activities. But then, all of a sudden, things started to change in the Soviet Union. This was the time when Brezhnev died, and when all of a sudden this sort of fixed Cold War reality, there were cracks in that building, and you felt, and I got really interested in international relations, and so I started to study political science and international relations, and through that I got interested in development and in what is driving development and what not, and I saw the opportunity to link that interest to an interest on environmental issues, and so that's how I ended up in that field.
And where did the interest in environment come from?
I think I've always had a bit of an interest in that. When I was 7 or 8 years old, my father took me to the biggest book fair of the country, and we came home with a book on animal species that were threatened with extinction. I've always had a keen interest in the outdoors. Being a city kid in a flat country with dense population, Belgium, I was dreaming about mountains and about wilderness and about camping and hiking, maybe things that in New Zealand you take for granted, but not where I come from. And so I've had this urge to experience nature and the outdoors, and I got an interest in why it is that we are ruining some of the most beautiful things out there, and why we don't have the capacity to do this in a better way. And so I rolled into environmental policy.
And you went off to Colorado State to do that?
Yeah, I was a researcher at the university, and you know, I was talking to my professor about my PhD research, and I hinted at I want to do something on how environmental degradation contributes to violent conflicts. And he sort of looked at me and said, can you not work on a more serious topic? And I thought, you know what, you have to choose your battles wisely, because I really respected him. He was a very sharp and motivating person, but this was clearly not even on his radar. And so I started to look for places where I could do that. And I looked in Europe, I looked across the Atlantic to the US, and I found a fantastic place in the US that was willing to give me a scholarship to get my PhD, and I moved to Colorado State. And that was really a game-changing moment for me because of the very different academic culture, very open, very flat structure. I mean, the professors became colleagues and friends almost. Plus also it was a department that was really focusing on environment and energy and climate issues. About half of the professors in that department were political scientists working on environmental issues, and anybody doing their PhD or even a master's thesis there had to work on those topics. So there was a critical mass of focus, and I felt like a fish in the water there. So I really got a fantastic opportunity there.
And you got to be close to the mountains that you'll be dreaming of.
No kidding. Living in Colorado was not a punishment. We lived at 1,600 meters at the foot of the Rocky Mountains. It was an unbelievable environment. To every free moment we spend outdoors in the outback. I loved it. Yeah, I've never felt so much in sync with the natural environment as I have in Colorado. When I go back there, it feels like coming home. Still today. Yeah.
You've got a coffee cup here from Moab.
Yeah, well, yeah.
It couldn't be more. That environment couldn't be more different from the European environment of itself.
Yes, and I love it. I love the openness. I love the sort of endless space. I love that. Also, the silence which you can have there. The fact that you can walk with a map into a canyon system, not in a national park where it's like the Disneyland of nature. You know, traffic jams in a national park are not my idea of enjoying nature. But, feeling in touch with what surrounds you in a sort of almost emotional way. And I think that sort of experience has really changed me in many ways. And the Moab thing, we were back as a family this summer in the U.S. because my son participated in the Special Olympic Games in L.A. So we went to cheer him on. Mm-hmm. And then we spent time in California and Utah in the environment, in nature, exposing our kids to that sort of environment. And we ended up in Colorado visiting friends there. And then I came back to work. So yeah.
Well, no, you can't see it through their eyes, but what did they see that was different from the Europe that they've grown up in?
The endless environment, for one thing. Also the sort of everything being really big in the United States. Mm-hmm. And they even in California, which is the green state, the cars are huge and the houses are huge, and so they it sort of hit them in the face to say, wow, what is this, you know?
There's a very, very strong distinction between the urban and this nature.
Yeah.
Out there somewhere, isn't there?
Absolutely. Yeah. And we don't, the concept of wilderness also. When we were out in the canyons, we saw snakes and we saw scorpions. And if you grow up as a kid in Belgium, there is no wilderness. That's a concept that is completely foreign. A spider in your bathroom is the closest thing to wilderness.
Yeah, or it's a fairy tale. Or something somewhere
and
else.
And they got exposed to that. And also the sort of endless landscapes that you can have there. I thought it was a very good experience for them. Yeah.
But somewhere like Belgium has had a society that's successfully been there for a very long time.
Yep, Absolutely.
So they've managed to merge the nature and the community.
To a certain extent, but not necessarily so. I mean, I think a lot of people in many cities around the globe probably are rather far removed from what their interaction with nature is. And I don't think we can solve that solely by teaching kids in school about nature. It's not only about cognitive appreciation, about learning about species and systems. That is important, but I'm a strong believer in experiences. Yeah. In Europe, it's very normal that by the time you're 18, your school has taken you to Paris and to London, and nowadays, you know, maybe to Rome or Barcelona, or because it's part of our culture and you need to be exposed to that, which is all fine. But how about exposing kids to nature and to the sort of natural basis of our existence? We do very little of that. And sometimes I wonder, when I was growing up and the school took you to Paris or to London, you could still have the idea of, okay, this is my opportunity to go to London, yeah? Because families didn't travel much and all of that. Nowadays, by the time they're 20 years old, they've taken a Ryanair ticket to Barcelona and they've been in Rome and they've been here and there. So maybe we should reflect also on what type of experiences and exposure do we give young people in light of the world that they are living in.
Now, you went off to Colorado the first time thinking that you were going to do a PhD on environmental degradation and relationship with that, with violent conflicts. Is that what you ended up doing?
Yeah, I did that. I did that, which was a fascinating topic because there was very little published on it. Very little. But people were all interested in it. And again, you know, writing a dissertation can be an arduous process, and a lot of people are sick and tired of it by the time they're done. I wasn't. I loved it till the last minute that I worked on it. There was a very small community in the world that was working on these topics. Probably the most well-known was Thomas Homer Dixon, a Canadian professor at Toronto University. There was the Peace Research Institute in Oslo and the Swiss Peace Foundation, and that was about it. So I became a part of a small research community, and I really loved it, yeah. And I looked at case studies, the civil war in El Salvador. I wrote a sort of environmental account, natural resource account of that, how that was a driving force. I looked at the Horn of Africa and the role that desertification and resource scarcity, land in particular, and water played there. And then closer to where you are located, I looked at the Bougainville Panguna mine conflict as a huge resource and degradation conflict. So this was I loved doing it, yeah.
Mm. And they're still digging their way out of that nest.
Yeah. That yeah.
And have you gone back to that professor that said it wasn't serious and talked it through as a serious topic?
And yes, of course. But I mean, as I said, I think you have to see the context of things. Eh? You need to see the context in which academic careers and intellectual lives are building, and yeah, probably I felt and saw a changing context and I wanted to be part of it. So this is in no way a negative sort of appreciation of the people that trained me well and had confidence in me as a young researcher, but just I felt that I needed to move on in the direction that I thought I needed to move in. Yeah.
We don't have time to go through your career step by step, so let's skip forward to the job you're doing.
Yeah.
So you are the executive director of the European Environment Agency.
Yeah.
Do you sometimes look at the nameplate and think, how did that happen?
Well, I've always built a research career after I started to work, after my PhD. I wanted to do research that had relevance, and I strongly believe in the sort of responsibility that comes with knowledge and the privileged position which you have as a researcher in society. You know, you're paid by the taxpayer to work on things that are of interest to you, and you can build yourself. And so I wanted to do policy relevant research, and when I was 48, I was looking for information on the website of the agency, and I saw that they were looking for a new director, And I thought, you know what, with my career in academia and on policy research, let's see what I'm worth in this type of very different environment. And well, round after round, I stayed in the game and I ended up in this role. And I feel an incredible privilege because this is a fantastic institution. We work with top people from all around Europe. We work with some of the most influential institutions. There is no other place on the planet that makes binding environmental and climate legislation for 28 countries. We are connected to some of the best research institutions. So even today, I mean, once a week at least, I sort of have to squeeze into my cheek and say, you're a lucky guy that you can do this. You know, what a privilege it is to do this type of work. Yeah.
Who do you report to?
Well, we don't really report to anybody. Our closest institutional context is the Directorate General on the Environment, DG Env, in Brussels. But we work closely together with DG Climate Action, Klima. We work with Regio. We work with Research. We work with Mare on maritime issues. We work with several of them. We also work with our member countries. We work with the Parliament, the Environment Commission of the European Parliament, the Transport Commission of the European Parliament. So, in fact, we produce material that serves that policy community. But of course, I have a board. You know, the organization has a board, and in the board we have our 33 member countries all sitting behind their national flag, and we have the European Parliament and the European Commission being there. So it's quite an embedded institution of the European architecture.
The strap line is independent information on the environment.
We come with what we call timely, targeted, relevant, and reliable information. And I think all four of them are of crucial importance. Of course, you need to be reliable, otherwise you have no voice. Huh? Of course, you need to be relevant. And that's something I think when you think of the science policy or knowledge policy interface, that is not always grasped by academics. What is relevant, you know, and how do you frame it in relevant terms? And then the timeliness, it doesn't make sense to come with a report on something 3 weeks after the big decision is made. So we are in continuous dialogue with the institutions in Brussels or with the member states to understand what the cycle is of the policy agenda, to come at a moment in that cycle where our knowledge is relevant. And then, of course, targeted. You want to bring information in a way that policymakers have an uptake. Yeah? If you have a highly scientific type of language that is only understood by 20 experts in Europe, you're certainly not going to have a big impact on the policy-making scene.
What's the scope of the environment that you're reporting on?
Well, we do, I would say, the traditional environment of water quality, air quality. We work on soil, we work on, you know, that sort of more traditional agenda. Waste, yeah, and materials. That is now closer to the circular economy agenda in Europe. But we also do more integrated things. Transport, environment, and health, or agriculture and environmental nexus issues, or green taxation, or, you know, that sort of issue. So we are not just monitoring and reporting on NOx and SOx and PPMs and micrograms, and, you know, that's not how we identify.
Yeah. So is there an equivalent agency that does social reporting?
Well, the European institutions have several agencies. There are those on social issues, there are those on more economic issues, on security issues. And then, of course, there is the Eurostat, the big statistical office. And so if you take all of that together, I think we have a kaleidoscopic but pretty complete view of where we stand in Europe when it comes to socio-economic and environmental developments.
I was thinking, if you're trying to write something about climate change, then it's almost as much a social issue as it is a environmental technical issue.
But we integrate that rather fundamentally in what it is we are doing. We talk about the economic dimension of things. We in our latest five-year report, we make a strong link with the agenda of innovation, of research and development, of the link with the sort of financial dynamics of issues. So that I think is a big step forward, where we do not. We have a much more systemic view, and we look at the four key systems in society which we think we will need to become fundamentally more sustainable. That's the energy system, the food and agricultural system, the transport and mobility system, and the urban and built environment system. And of course we look at that from an environment slash climate perspective, knowing very well that key drivers there can be your tax system, can be the financial system, can be a subsidy system, can be a technology lock-in. So all of those elements are connected, and we try to be a piece in the knowledge puzzle there. And I think our added value is also in sort of connecting the dots. Huh? I think that's of importance.
What's your go-to definition of sustainability?
It's, for me, it's the title of the Senate Environmental Action Program. It's living well within the limits of the planet. That also means taking those limits very seriously as a boundary condition. It's not living well and also thinking about the environment. It's living well within the limits of the planet. It's a very different thing. And
is that intentionally ambiguous with the well? Could apply to living well or the well within the limits?
No, I think it's about living well.
Mm-hmm.
Within the limits of the planet.
We don't want to get right to those limits.
No.
We want to stay well back to those limits.
But the real meaning is, I think, that as I said earlier today, also in the meeting that you referred to, we need to move away from this idea that we somehow have to pay attention in the social and the economic also for the environment. Eh? And when we do that, we call it sustainability. No, in the long run, on a finite planet with limited resources and more people rightly demanding a serious or a decent lifestyle, it's not about adding a little bit of environment to social and economic development. It's about fundamentally organizing our society while embracing, I would say, the boundary conditions. And the boundary conditions are about the environment and about climate and about natural resources. That's the real meaning for me of sustainability.
Do you split sustainability into social, environmental, and economic? Does that make sense to you?
No, it doesn't. We need a higher integrated approach to that. The issue is not to add a green pillar to the economy and then pop a bottle of champagne when the green economy grew by 50% because it went from 4 to 6% of the economy. The real success is about greening the economy, which in essence means a very different way of dealing with our natural resources. You know, going from a sort of linear model where you dig up stuff, you produce something, you use it a limited number of years or times, and then you just throw it away. We need, circular economy. It's about decarbonization of our core systems, and also about energy efficiency, so rethinking the energy system. And it's about fundamentally understanding the value of ecosystems and natural capital. And we see that all over the place. The so-called conflict between agriculture and nature, which you see in so many countries, I don't think the fundamental question is how can we solve the conflict between nature people and farmers. I think the fundamental question is how have we come to a system of food production and consumption that is a key stress factor on the environment, whereas the basis should be the environment. So that is, I think, the key question we should be asking. And that points to a much more integrated view on long-term sustainability.
You described this morning the pillars model, the Venn diagram model of sustainability as intellectual nonsense.
Over the long term, yes, it is intellectual nonsense. Because you cannot have a little bit of sustainability on a finite planet. We will have to make our core systems of production and consumption essentially sustainable. Because we have added quite a bit of sustainability aspects to them over the last 20 years. We can be proud of the policy performance in Europe. We have decoupled our economic production to a large extent from forms of pollution, from, but in essence, we need to think at a deeper and more systemic level about the long-term sustainability, and that is moving from this Venn diagram, to the sort of egg model where we organize our socio-technical systems and our well-being within the limits of the planet, not while taking the environment into account. That's a pretty fundamental paradigm shift.
Even that egg or bullseye model, that it still has the systems as separate systems.
Well, but if you look at the design that we made, they are together and partially overlapping. So we obviously see the nexus, the so-called nexus issues between environment and agriculture. Between energy and agriculture, between agriculture and transport. We see those connections. And that is the more systemic dimension that we need to understand in the future.
So if we're looking for systemic change, what do we need to change?
I think we first need to understand better two essential things. We need to understand the dynamics of lock-in in the current characteristics of unsustainability. Yeah. And then we also need to understand how we can nurture niche innovation and give that the space to become more mainstream and to upscale. And there we will have to accept failure. Because it's so fundamental, it will require experimentation, it will require thinking out of the box, acting out of the box, and we cannot expect all of what we invest in that to all of a sudden work. Yeah? I think we also need to pay attention to the sort of creative labs that are out there in many of our cities, where citizens of all ages, I would say, in all walks of life, are trying to find answers to the challenges that we see in their own way. And so capturing, on the one hand, that sort of niche potential and innovation, and on the other hand, understanding what locks us into the unsustainability, I think is key. And a key issue that has risen to on the agenda in the last years is the so-called environmentally harmful subsidies. If you look at the International Energy Agency, OECD work, World Bank work, our work, many other institutions, there is an increased attention to the sort of financial flows that support unsustainable practices, while policies are already directing in a different direction. If you think of the renewables debate, well, we are spending quite a bit of subsidy money on the non-renewable energy sources. That, of course, in the end, is not sustainable.
So can we get this systemic change, this transition that you're looking for, can we get there incrementally?
Well, I think the jury is out there. I think in some ways, yes, it can go in incremental steps. If you think of urban mobility, yeah. I think I'm living here in Copenhagen now. This is a city that has done quite a bit on sustainable mobility in a sort of planned incremental way, but questioning the fundamentals. Yeah. This is a city that is now functioning at the speed of bicycles. Yeah. That's quite a paradigm shift when you think of cities organized around car use. Huh? But then they had a matching plan attached to it. Some of it will be more disruptive, I think. That's the whole thinking about disruptive technologies, about serious steps in shorter time periods to move away, for example, from these harmful subsidies. So I think it will be a mix of more abrupt change and more incremental change. And we need to understand where the tipping points are also. When can you say, okay, we're now entering a really new paradigm? And last year was the first year that we added more renewable energy capacity than traditional energy capacity. Is that the tipping point? That might be a tipping point. Yeah. So those things, I think, matter. I think it's a bit naive to yell from the sidelines, we need a revolution. That's quite easy when you're on the sidelines. Huh? But when you're trying to push from within the system, you also understand that one shouldn't underestimate the forces that are embedded in the current system.
But are they forces for change, or are they forces that are benefiting from the current unsustainable system?
Well, I think it's a bit of both, because I strongly believe in the capacity of the system also to point in the right direction. I mean, the 7th Environment Action Program of the EU is a very progressive and rather fundamental document. It was framed after this 2008 economic crisis, where everybody said, oh my God, it's all about the economy and jobs and growth now, and nobody has any attention anymore for our agenda. Well, apparently that was not true, right? We have the circular economy package now that is being formulated under conditions where people say, well, the new commission doesn't even pay attention to the environment. Well, they are working on a new package which the promises will come back with more ambition, stronger ambition. So I tend to believe in the adaptive and forward-looking capacity also of institutions. But of course you need pressure from society. Of course you need solid academic and other knowledge work to point in the direction. Of course you need critical voices outside and inside of the system.
Is your job, the agency's job, to provide not just the information but that critical voice?
I think we are an independent agency. Yeah? Of course we cannot just do what we want. We have a board with the institutions and the member countries in it, but I think it's our duty to provide relevant information, which means what we do, I think, should be aligned with the policy agenda. How we do it, that's where our independence is. And I think, yes, we are a critical voice. We've always been a critical voice. So in essence, I think we do three things. We report on the state of the environment. It's essential that we know about water quality and air quality and what we are doing with waste policies and all of that, and biodiversity. We also do these more integrated assessments. Hey, what is the link between air quality and transport and health in cities? That's a more critical voice, because to understand the key dynamics behind these things is often a rather critical, fundamental message to policymakers. And the third thing which we do, I would say, is we contribute to the continuous innovation in our approaches to environment and climate policies in Europe.
Are policymakers your primary audience?
That's how we have prioritized, and that's also our mandate. Our mandate says that we have to provide knowledge and information to the policymakers in Europe, which means the European level institutions, which means the member countries, but also other actors, the civil society actors, economic actors. So we have a rather broad scope, but I would say the primary actors are the institutions in Brussels and our key partners in the member countries.
I was looking at the publications that have come out of this institution in the last month or so, mm-hmm. and they're enormously wide-ranging.
Yep.
How does a policymaker possibly keep on top of that?
That's our role as translators, right? We make sure that we get to the policymakers that are relevant for a specific topic in a pointed way. They know when things are coming out. We know when they need them, so that there is attention. We have also paid quite a bit of attention in the last couple of years in how we frame our messages, how we present them with infographics more than complicated scientific graphs. So yes, there is a lot coming out, but we have a very conscious communication approach into reaching the right audiences at the right time. And therefore, we don't consider communication as sort of the tail end, advertisement part of what it is we do. It's an integral part of the approach which we have towards the policy making scene.
You talked this morning about a knowledge base to support transitions and what's required in terms of how that information is being generated and presented. And you talked about moving from, or moving to complexity, moving to non-linearity, and to problems. I don't think you used the word wicked problems, but recognizing the complexity of those sorts of problems. All of those are moving away from the ability to present a nice, simple story that someone can grasp straight away.
Yeah, but I don't agree with that. To quote Einstein, we should make things as simple as possible, but not simpler than that. Yeah, I think if we understand that the challenges which we are changing are systemic and rather complex, and that there are degrees of uncertainty in that, we should find a language, we should find images to communicate that. Because it would be almost intellectually dishonest to present them as single cause issues or as rather simple issues, which is what you find now on many of these social media platforms or reactions to newspaper articles. If only we would do this simple thing, we would solve it. Well, probably not. Most issues in society are rather complex. If it would only take a 5-minute decision in one direction, probably we would have done it. So I think we have a duty to explain complexity and uncertainty, but we have to do it in terms that speak to those who need to make the decisions. And that's not easy, but I think the images which I've used on the sort of moving from an efficiency to a transitions paradigm today, they speak to people. They grasp them. Yeah.
You also used the metaphor like that you described your body as an ecosystem.
Yeah.
Therefore, it's political. Those sorts of metaphors do carry quite a lot of a strong message.
Yeah, well, this was talking to an expert audience in a sort of academic knowledge setting. This is not necessarily what I would say in the European Parliament. I could frame the same message in a different way. I mean, the air we breathe that enters my body, it's the result of policies that have been implemented or not. So in a way, that is political. What I eat is political. And I think the food system is a nice example, because yes, you choose what you eat, and yes, we want people to make smart food choices, but they do it in a system that has been adding fat, sugar and salt to just about anything you buy in the shop. So it's the sort of structure agency debate in social sciences, where I think we all have a responsibility, but we do it within the systems that surround us. And in the agency, we try to send a clear message around the complexity of those systems and the impact which policymakers can have on shaping them in ways that also allows citizens and consumers to make different choices in a more easy way.
Do you structure all of your communication around some standard themes? Is there a...
Yes and no. Yes and no. We have different communication outlets. We have our reports. We have the shorter how do you call that, press releases. We have a couple of more accessible ways. We are moving more to the web, and those are the channels. But we also have a communication framework in the agency, and a core part of that, I think, is that we agreed on 5 narratives that will be driving our communication in the next 5 years. And that creates consistency. in what it is we are saying. And it's sort of the storyline that frames things. And that is helpful when we bring messages. Yeah. One of the key storylines for me is environmental issues are not on the outskirts of the debate. This is about production and consumption, and hence about who we are as a modern society. So it's at the center of societal debate. It's at the center of economic debate. It's at the center of distributional issues, and hence social issues. Because still, for in the mind of a lot of people, environmental issues are sort of on the outside. Huh? Yeah, if we solve the social and the economic, we will have time to talk about. Yeah, you're not in the room. Yes, we are in the room. That's a key narrative that I think is important.
And that avoids people considering living well within the planet's limits as a luxury.
It's a necessity, it's not a luxury. And I think one of the other key things is also we are not doomsday thinkers nor communicators. I mean, yes, we have serious information, and yes, we need to face reality, huh? Whether it's on implementation gaps, or whether it's on trend lines that are not very positive, or those who are positive. But I think we have found a language to say, look, the problems are serious, but we see a lot of pathways, or at least the potential pathways, to move out of this and go into a better life that is future oriented. And that, I think, has opened a lot of doors for our message.
I was looking at the mega trends that the agency works on, so urbanization, changing disease burdens, so on. Continued economic growth has got a question mark on the end of it. Is that because we don't know if that's going to happen, or because we don't think it can happen?
Well, I think one has to be realistic about growth. Huh? I've spent quite a bit of my research time in Africa, and in parts of Asia, and also Latin America when I was a researcher at the university. I invite anybody from a rich OECD country to stand on a marketplace in a West African country and say, guys, we intellectuals in the West have decided that we can't afford growth anymore. It's done, yeah. You better be a fast runner, because they will rip you apart. Huh? So I think it's clear that a couple of billion people on this planet are craving for growth. They are craving for educational opportunities. They are craving for a decent house. They are craving for a city that is not as unhealthy as it is there. Basic infrastructure, energy systems. That doesn't mean we need energy systems that are unsustainable. That doesn't mean that we need to organize those urban infrastructures around individual car use. That doesn't mean we need food systems there that are based on unsustainable consumption of meat and sugar. But I think the qualitative sort of growth that is needed is there. We cannot ignore it. That would be highly unethical. So we need to reflect on what growth means in a global perspective, and also draw the consequences for those of us who are probably not in need of a lot of quantitative growth, to the contrary, and who need to reflect on the footprint of our current lifestyle.
Because it's quite a different thing about the people that clearly need to be improving the human development in Africa or Southeast Asia or wherever. We can't really use that as an excuse for continued growth in Scandinavia or America.
No, we need to understand, I think, that we increasingly depend on global value chains and natural resource flows, and on environmental impacts that are globalizing, but at the same time we need to recognize that we're in a completely different position, and we need to take responsibility. It's not because we in the West have evolved into a society with way too large of a footprint, to use that image, that everybody else all of a sudden has the right to also first go to that footprint because we did it. No, we all have our responsibility. The responsibility of those who are in need and have a full right to an energy system that is appropriate. We collectively should reflect on what pathway is it we want to follow there. Yeah, and if you look at African countries and the potential for renewable energy there, small-scale solar, for example, or biomass, or you know, all sorts of other innovative technologies, is huge. While at the same time, we know that we need to fundamentally move to a different energy system, to a different food system. So it's not an either or. I think it's an understanding of collective responsibility.
You said that an area that we need to focus on is acting local, but we need acting local to scale.
Yeah, it's not either local or global. Mm-hmm. It's at all levels. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's at all levels.
Okay, some questions to finish with then. What's the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
I would say the fact that we have been able as an agency to produce our State and Outlook of the Environment report and send rather fundamental messages about the need for transitions in a way that engages others to discuss and think of a positive future, and not in a way that closes the debate or marginalizes the message.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
I consider myself to be somebody who is very much convinced of the responsibility that comes with knowledge and with a specific role that one plays. So yes, I think I have the duty to use the agency, and I don't mean that the institution EEA, but the agency that I have as an actor. Yeah, and in that sense, I could be considered an activist. Yeah,
because even as an academic, you were active in
the environmental organization. Yeah, I was. Yeah, I was.
There's not a conflict in those.
I never suffered from that. I didn't see the conflict. I had a very clear line there. No, I didn't see the conflict.
What motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
Well, professionally, it's I love what I'm doing now because it is science-based or knowledge-based, value-based policy work. Yeah. And so I don't just manage whatever. It's really, I'm a knowledge person. That's my whole professional life. Huh? And so it's knowledge and value based in a highly relevant context. And I find that fantastic that I'm allowed to do this. Yeah.
What challenges have you got in the next couple of years?
To translate our fundamental analysis in a way that keeps the momentum in Europe going in the direction of transition. Because we're building a knowledge base, there is an openness for our message, but of course we are, you know, still getting out of a crisis. We are questioning in some corners of Europe the whole enterprise of Europe. There are other challenges. How do we keep the sort of momentum for change going at this moment in Europe? And I think we need to contribute to that through a knowledge perspective as an agency. And that's a challenge. Yeah.
And there's some big conferences coming up.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Are they going to deliver?
We hope so, yeah. I think it's quite essential that Paris delivers a credible message, a message that is in some way binding for actors, and a message that is having everybody on board. Yeah? This is not just something for OECD countries anymore, it's a global exercise. And so, yeah, I think it's absolutely essential that it delivers. And so I'm hopeful. Yeah.
If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur by the time you wake up tomorrow morning, what would that be?
That the discourse that environmental and climate policies are against economic interests would disappear from the face of the planet.
Okay, so what's the smallest thing that we could do that would help that along its miracle way?
For me, it's on a daily basis. The smallest thing is, I think, my mobility pattern. For me, a bicycle is a... And the way this city of Copenhagen is facilitating me to use it, that's a small thing, but I enjoy it every single time I'm on my bicycle. And every single time I think, what a difference with the city that I grew up in, Antwerp or Brussels, where they are the two most congested cities in Europe for the moment. So that for me is a small thing to do, yeah, but significant.
And lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
If I would have any advice, it would be that pessimism has never solved anything. So we have to be realistic optimists, you know, because that motivates us to be active participants of change. In other words, if you want change, try to be the change you want to be. You see, that's sort of what I would say. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Yeah.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio.
You've been listening to Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. We broadcast on Otago Access Radio, oar.org.nz, and podcast on sustainablelens.org. On sustainablelens.org, we're building up a searchable archive of conversations with people from many different fields who are applying their skills to a sustainable future. In our conversations, we try to find out what motivates them and what it means to see the world through a sustainable perspective, through their sustainable lens. Tonight's sustainable lens was that of Professor Hans Brownings, the Executive Director of the European Environment Agency. You can follow the links on sustainablelens.org to find us on Facebook, and you can listen to Sustainable Lens via iTunes for free and all the other usual poddy places. That was Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann. I hope you enjoyed the show.